From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Last weekend, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, said that the U.S. southern border is closed. And that news on Sunday came just days after the House of Representatives signed off on a couple bills that would seek to clear the path for certain migrants to be able to get permanent resident status. That's some of the latest news coming out of Washington and elsewhere involving immigration. And let's get an update on things here in Northwest Indiana as well from our person we've talked to the most about the issue of immigration lately, Alfredo Estrada. He's a partner and he's a member of the law firm of Burke, Costanza, and Carberry here in Northwest Indiana. He's an immigration attorney, and we welcome you back to Regionally Speaking, sir.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. Last time we spoke, I mentioned that immigration law changes sometimes daily.
Yeah.
And the day after we spoke and our last interview was aired, immigration law changed. So we're here again.
Are we finding that we're getting more messages out of the Biden administration that will affect Northwest Indiana undocumented immigrants as well as those who are legally here in the country?
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, what the Biden administration did since we last talked was, one, issue an executive order regarding temporary protective status for Venezuelans. And that is a status that allows individuals from designated countries such as Venezuela the ability to get work authorization and then a promise not to deport despite their status because of country conditions back home. This is going to be available for Venezuelans. They can apply up until early September, and it's going to be an 18-month status here that is generally renewed as long as the country conditions do not change. For example, in Haiti, due to the 2010 earthquake and other countries, they're designated for the same status. They're reviewed annually and generally extended. So it affects quite a bit of Northwest Indiana residents.
Mm-hmm. I know that at least it's come out so far, and some of the reports have mentioned this in more detail about the fact that I guess the Biden administration wants to provide an 8-year path to citizenship. And how does things stand on that right now, and your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so we have the, I guess you would call it the Dreamer Bill, right? The bill for those who are currently Dreamers or DACA recipients and those of the like who would... that's currently in front of the Senate, and I believe Senator Dick Durbin said he believes he has the vote to get it passed. What we don't know is how that bill, the House bill, is going to be, you know, amended or changed or mutilated and what the ultimate outcome is. We're going to have to see whether how they treat those who have already been under DACA, those who graduated high school versus those who graduated college, and those who are currently enrolled in school. And that was currently enrolled was a bit of an issue during the early days of DACA for older adults who qualified for DACA but didn't complete high school and then enrolled in a GED program and what qualified as a requisite GED program for DACA purposes. So we're awaiting the Senate to act not only on that bill but the bill that would authorize legal status for farm workers as well.
What do you feel would have to happen next in the process for the Biden administration's plan to go into effect?
Well, you know, these are two bills that were a part of his overall comprehensive immigration reform package that the Biden administration kind of had a plan for. I think overwhelmingly a bill that affects Dreamers is popular and by bipartisan support nationwide. So that's going to be a bit of a test to see the appetite for immigration reform in a democratically controlled House and ultimately a democratically controlled Senate with the tie vote going to the vice president, right? So if we cannot, or the Biden administration cannot, successfully pass a Dreamer bill, despite the popularity of doing so and bipartisan support, that is pretty much fair and close to what was in the House, I don't see much going forward as to comprehensive immigration reform in his administration.
Are you finding in talking with your clients as well as with people that know them here in Northwest Indiana that they're still very concerned about what we're going to be hearing in the days and weeks ahead out of Washington about what the policies may be and certainly the bills that are still making their way through Congress?
Yeah, everybody I talk to, whether immigrant or not, is aware of what's going on and concerned about the ultimate package that we're gonna get if we get one. And, you know, the region has responded to that. My clients have, and they're concerned. And for example, Chris, shortly after the election, the Hammond Legal Aid Clinic began serving immigrants in legal services there. So it's one of that clinic and that program's one of, one of the only in the state of Indiana that serves immigrants through public funds.
We're speaking now to you. You're on your way to Indianapolis. Are you headed down to talk to lawmakers about this, some of these latest issues involving immigration here in the region?
I'm headed down to Indianapolis as my role as the president for the Rudy Lozano Bar Association. Mm-hmm. It's to testify against in opposition to House Bill 1453, which would drastically change the makeup of the Lake County Judicial Nominating Commission. So, nothing immigration here. I have another hat on today as we drive down to Indy, but we're still going to, I'm in my efforts to support the Lozano Bar.
Well, I know that's one thing I'm glad you did mention. We do know that's a measure that has been introduced by members of the legislature here in Northwest Indiana, and we haven't heard much about the bill. We haven't even had, I guess, much as to whether it's actually gone through the session or not. What's the status of the measure that you're speaking against as you make your way down there?
Well, we were under the impression that it was not going to be heard by a Senate committee, and then late last week we got word that the Judiciary Senate Committee is going to hear it today with some amendments. The amendments are changing the Judicial Nominating Commission from two governor appointees and two Lake County Commissioner appointees, with the Chief Justice or his appointee serving as the tie-breaking vote and only would vote in the event of a tie. And that it would be, the bill would take immediate effect. And I think that is, the immediate effect issue is more about the two, I believe there's two openings in St. Joseph County right now.
Right.
Judicial openings that's of concern, and undoubtedly once there's factions that want to have a control over that. But the issue here and what our concern is, and Chris, I'll be testifying to the same, is right now if you look at the Indiana Court of Appeals, the Indiana Supreme Court, Northern District of Indiana, and the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, not one Latino sits on any of those courts. In fact, if a resident of Lake County was to file had a case in the federal court, they wouldn't get in front of a Latino judge or African-American judge until the United States Supreme Court. And that's an issue, right? We're looking at the lack of diversity within the court systems for those that have jurisdiction over Lake County residents. So that's an issue we recognize as the Lozano Bar and want to speak about today.
Well, Alfredo, thank you for taking time as you make your way down to Indianapolis to talk about not only your testimony you're going to make before the Senate Judiciary Committee down there on this measure that affects the judiciary in Lake County, but also to the stance about how Northwest Indiana, not only undocumented immigrants, but legal immigrants here in Lake County, certainly will face here what's happening in Washington. Thanks for spending time, and a safe trip to Indy, and let us know how things turn out on the measure that is being considered today.
All right, thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. I look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you. That's Alfredo Estrada. He is a member of the law firm of Burke, Costanza, and Carberry. He's an immigration attorney, and he's representing immigration as well as other attorneys here in Lake County for that meeting in Indianapolis. And the governor's laid out the way ahead for the state of Indiana and what we all hope will be the final stretch of the pandemic. Sharon Jackson has a report.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb on Tuesday delivered a statewide address to lay out the road ahead for Hoosiers in the fight against COVID-19. Indiana's current cases, positivity rate, hospitalizations, and deaths have all dropped drastically since mid-January, and nearly a million Hoosiers are fully vaccinated. The state plans to open vaccine eligibility to all Hoosiers 16 years and older on Wednesday, March 31st, provided Indiana receives a large increase in the amount of vaccine as outlined by the federal government. Additional mass vaccination clinics will be scheduled for April, and the state will implement a large employer vaccination program. Starting April 6th, decisions about venue capacity and social gatherings will be made by local officials. Customers in restaurants, bars, and nightclubs will no longer be required by the state to be seated. 6 feet of spacing between tables and other seating will still be recommended, as is spacing between non-household parties. The statewide face covering mandate will become a mask advisory on April 6th. Face coverings will remain mandatory in all state buildings and facilities and in vaccination and COVID testing sites until further notice. K through 12 schools will continue under current requirements through the remainder of the 2020-21 school year. Local governments, private businesses, and other entities may institute more stringent guidelines. The Indiana Department of Health will continue to provide county-level color-coded metrics to provide easy-to-understand information about whether virus levels are increasing or decreasing locally. The state public health emergency will be renewed for another 30 days, beginning April 1st. This declaration allows the state to act quickly if conditions take a turn for the worse and allows the state to continue to access hundreds of millions of federal dollars to support Hoosiers recovering from the impacts of the pandemic. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
1 year into the pandemic, COVID-19 has put an enormous strain on healthcare systems, including the influx of COVID-19 patients, staffing shortages, and budget crunches. We continue our reflection series with hospital officials and healthcare workers talking about these changes. Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs checked with some of the state's hospitals and healthcare workers to see how they're doing.
Joel Wells says the worst moments at rural Wayne County Hospital came last fall when COVID-19 hospitalizations were spiking statewide. Wells is a family physician in the third decade of his career. At the time, he says he had 9 COVID-19 patients. That's a lot for a 25-bed rural critical access hospital in south central Iowa.
We had to make lots of decisions on the fly. We had patients that really, when I say were critical, they were. We had quite a few deaths at that time.
But Wells says facing surges of sick patients was far from the only challenge his hospital has faced in the past year. He says some patients have aggressively pushed back against his public health recommendations. That's something he says he and his colleagues never expected to experience during a pandemic.
We, as a medical profession, don't have the trust that I thought we did. It just rocked my world. I just said, oh man, people really don't want to listen to me.
On top of all that, Wells says about half of the Wayne County Hospital staff had to be furloughed last summer to deal with COVID-related budget shortfalls. These challenges aren't limited to small hospitals like Wayne County.
There were multiple moments that when we were standing on the edge of the cliff, you never thought the cliff could be steeper.
Suresh Gunasekaran is the CEO of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, the state's largest hospital. He says there were times during last fall's surge when his region was reporting no available ICU beds. He says the entire healthcare system was completely stressed. And like Wayne County, Gunasekaran says UIHC experienced economic strain that trickled down to every single hardworking staff member.
We had folks that took pay cuts, and we had folks that gave back vacation and did these things that, you know, very much were stressful and very much were dollars out of their pockets.
A year of battling the coronavirus has left many hospitals and their workers across the country emotionally and financially drained. Aaron Wasilowski is the vice president of the American Hospital Association. His organization estimates hospitals lost $320 billion in 2020.
A lot of states imposed really strict bans on certain kinds of services, and people avoided certain services. So that resulted in and reduce revenue.
He says hospitals also faced increased expenses for personal protective gear and caring for COVID-19 patients. And Wasilowski says he anticipates hospitals will continue to face pandemic-related challenges for a long time, even with the vaccine now available. He says this year started with a massive surge in COVID-19 cases.
They put a tremendous strain on hospitals in terms of, you know, having ICUs that were essentially maxed out. So we think it'll be quite a while before we return to any sort of baseline.
But some hospitals seem to have fared better than others. Joanne Ropke-Bodie is the public relations manager for the Kossuth Regional Medical Center in northern Iowa, another rural 25-bed hospital. She says government support from the CARES Act helped the hospital avoid having to furlough staff. Ropke-Bodie says their biggest challenge in the last year was pacing and preparing for the virus. She says they were ready last spring for a surge in cases, but that didn't happen until months later, in late fall.
And then when cases came, I think people were already hitting COVID fatigue, you know, and they were just ready to move on. And that's when we kind of needed to really buckle down and say, oh, gosh, we need to stay home now.
In Wayne County, family doctor Joel Wells agrees pacing is a huge issue for many healthcare workers who quickly forgot that a pandemic is a marathon, not a sprint, and didn't stress that important message to the public.
We had a tendency to paint hope where there was no hope. This was going to be a long siege, and I think a lot of us saw that, and we just tried not to talk about it.
Wells says he knows the pandemic is far from over, but with the vaccine now available, he remains cautiously optimistic that a return to some normalcy is near. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today, and I'm Chris Nolte, along with Dee Dotson, and thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.